prepare for a true revolution.
Actually, you can prove God exists.
Questioning tradition, because what you've been taught isn't always true.
The truth will set you free.
The truth will set you free. Truth Revolution. I am Dave. With me is Pastor Jeff.
And this is where faith and reason meet.
They collide.
At Revolution Church on Truth Revolution Radio. Faith, reason. Right. We are glad you guys are here today. We have gotten a lot of feedback on the show this new year already. We've got a lot of listener questions. In fact, we're going to try to do three today.
What? It can't be done.
It can't be done. But we're going to do it.
Well, you know, it is our time. So we could just start off right away and do it like right now.
We could. We also got a Bible contradiction about Nephilim coming up. About Nephilim.
You clearing your throat there?
Nephilim. And we are going to be doing some content today, a little monologue about...
Some content? I'm glad we got content to do.
We're going
to
skip the content today. Now, we got content from C.S. Lewis's book, The Abolition of Man, the chapter Men Without Chest. And we're going to talk a little bit about that. Because this is really some interesting stuff.
Is Men Without Chest, is that talking about wimpy men or...
Yes.
Oh, is it really? Okay.
Yes, it's talking about men who have no boldness or conviction about truth and why that is.
Okay.
Things like that. So, yeah, it's really, really interesting stuff. But, you know, maybe you're right. Maybe we should start with a listener question right away. Let's go ahead and just jump right into the first question.
All right, listener question.
We've never done it this way before.
Too early.
I'm not sure what's going on. What show is this?
I don't know. Anyway, the listener question says, I was listening this morning to your discussion about inconsistencies between shades of white or gray as pertains to the Bible.
I think he's talking about, or she is talking about, a discussion we had about a Bible contradiction.
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking about, well, there's some gray area here. Okay,
right.
So go ahead.
Well, they say, what about this one? Ezekiel 8:20, the son shall not bear the iniquity of the father. Huh, the penalty of sin is placed on the sinner.
Okay.
Exodus 25 says, I, the Lord, thy God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the father upon the children unto the third and fourth generation. The penalty of sin goes on for generations.
Yes, so he's wondering.
We've done this Bible contradiction before.
Have we done this one before?
We have.
I don't even remember.
We've done so many.
We would need to look up the date.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't remember what we said about it before. I don't know.
Better be consistent there, Jeff.
If we had our cracked acronym or not. But, you know, we really hear the context is quite important, as well as the author's intention. What is the author trying to communicate by saying these things? Because you and I say things that are just, you know, like jumping off the Empire State Building crazy.
Uh-huh.
And now see what I just said there. You guys know that what I meant was something really, really very crazy.
Yeah, I didn't actually mean jumping off the Empire State
yes,
Building.
I didn't mean Dave's jumping off the Empire State Building.
You would only hope.
And so in the Bible, God, in a much more godly and un-Jeff way, uses hyperbole. He uses language that's D for dialect. Mm-hmm. We have to understand how he's talking here. And in Exodus 20, you know, where he says that he punishes people to the third and fourth generation, we don't want to just take that all the way out of context and say, okay, God hates sin so much that if you sin, he's going to punish your kids for your sin.
Right.
Because that's not what this is saying. Let's read the context here. Okay, Exodus 20, verses 5 and 6, it says, God's talking about idols, and he says, you shall not bow down to them or worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sin of the parents to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments.
Well, let me kind of interject something here.
Yeah.
I mean, if a person is hating God, of course their life is gonna go miserably.
Yeah.
I mean, because you hate the Creator.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that doesn't give you any kind of one-up or anything like that to make your life any better.
Right. Now, I don't want to say that just because you hate God, your life here will go miserably, necessarily. Some people may have a fantastic time on earth while they hate God.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, the point in this verse is making is it's saying that God is going to punish people for the sin of their parent. And some people actually say, no. What this really means is that the consequences of sin will come upon people. I don't think is what it says, though. It says God punishes the children for the sin of the parents to the third and fourth generation. But then there's this massive, epic qualifier.
Right.
He says, of those who hate me.
Right.
So if your parents were idolaters and worshipped Baal and hated the God of Israel, And then you hate the God of Israel and you worship Baal. And then your son hates the God of Israel and worships Baal.
Right.
The God of Israel is going to be punishing you for the same sins that he was punishing your parents for.
Right.
What God is not saying is, well, if your daddy told a lie, then I'm going to punish your kids for that.
Right.
That's not what he's saying. He's saying if you hate God in the same way that your father hated God, then you're going to get punished in the same way your father got punished. And you know this because, and he goes on, he says, and I show love to 1,000 generations of those who love me. It's not, hey, what did your dad do? What did your grandpa do? It's, do you love God or do you hate God? Because that's what God
did. So what you're saying is that a person that hates God can actually turn it around and start loving God and
absolutely
no longer be punished.
Absolutely. And the thing is, that's what Ezekiel, which was the supposed contradiction here, that's what Ezekiel says too. Because if you read the context of Ezekiel, it says, therefore, you Israelites, I will judge each of you according to your own ways, declares the sovereign Lord. Repent, turn away from your offenses, then sin will not be your downfall.
Right.
Rid yourselves of all the offenses you've committed and get a new heart and a new spirit. Why will you die, people of Israel? For I take no pleasure in the death of anyone, declares the sovereign Lord. Repent and live. And so you see, the whole point of Ezekiel is the same as the point of Exodus.
Mm-hmm.
If you hate God and sin, God will punish you. If you love God and follow his ways, God will not punish you.
There you go.
It's
cut and dry.
It's the exact same point in both of them. That's the answer for our first listener question.
I got a question.
All right.
Yes.
One down, two to go.
All right. So anyway, let's get into some of our other content for today. I just really wanted to cover some of this stuff from C.S. Lewis's book, Abolition of Man.
Right.
Let me read a teaser quote. This is what we're going to get to later.
Oh, he's going to give us a tease. Here we go.
It is the doctrine of objective value. The belief that certain attitudes are really true and others are really false to the kind of thing that the universe is and the kind of things we are.
What?
What, you didn't get that?
What did you just say? Okay. I understood the words. I didn't understand them in that order.
You said that before. Okay, let's just take this. Okay, the objective value.
Mm-hmm.
Do things have objective value or not?
Right.
Is
okay.
is the sunset beautiful or do I think it's beautiful?
Right. So you're saying beauty is in the eye of the beholder type
thing. Or is it not? Right.
Right.
And what we're going to talk about here today is that beauty is not my opinion.
Okay.
Beauty is real.
Okay, so we're here to refute that beauty is in the eye of the beholder.
Right. Now, also, your listeners might be going, well, who cares? Why are you talking about this? Because ultimately, this leads to moral relativism or moral absolutes, whether right and wrong are actually right and wrong or whether it's just someone's opinion.
Right, because we could say that if I say that sunset's beautiful and you say that sunset's
ugly.
It hurts. Ugly.
Yeah.
It hurts the eyes.
Yeah.
but we could take that one step further and be like, you know, well, I can do whatever I want because it's all relative to me.
Right. Like, well, punching someone's wrong. Well, right. I think it's beautiful to punch someone.
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, this seems like a big leap. And someone will be listening going, sunsets to punching people. I'm not sure I can make that jump. Here's why. And what C.S. Lewis takes us through this process in his book. And granted, some of the reading here is a little bit difficult or antiquated, but we're gonna talk through it. So
he definitely wrote in a different era.
He did. So in here, he's talking about Gaius and Titius, two authors who he's made up their name because he's trying to protect their identity. They wrote a book for elementary students, I believe.
Okay.
Okay, this is, they're trying to explain literature. And he's showing how even literature classes teach subjective morality in the way they treat things. Now he goes, they quote the well-known story of Coleridge at the waterfall. You remember that there were two tourists present, that one called it sublime and the other called it pretty, and that Coleridge mentally endorsed the first judgment and rejected the second with disgust.
Okay.
Okay, so one of these guys is saying, oh, well, yes, the waterfall is sublime, but to call it pretty is just, that's just stupid. Okay, you can't do that. They say, Gaius and Titius comment as follows. When the man said this is sublime, he appeared to be making a remark about the waterfall. Actually, he was not making a remark about the waterfall, but a remark about his own feelings. What he was saying was really, I have feelings associated in my mind with the word sublime, or shortly, I have sublime feelings. Okay, that's what they're saying.
Okay.
And you hear that and you think, well, that's true. When I say that the waterfall is beautiful, what I'm really saying is I actually have these beautiful feelings.
Right.
But that's not true. That's not actually what happens. Because as C.S. Lewis goes on to explain, he says, even on their own view, on any conceivable view, the man who says this is a sublime cannot mean I have sublime feelings. Even if it were granted that such qualities as sublimity were simple and solely projected into things from our own emotions, yet the emotions which prompt the projection are the correlatives and therefore almost the opposites of the qualities projected. The feelings which make a man call an object sublime are not sublime feelings, but feelings of veneration. Okay, do you have any idea what he's saying there?
Yeah, I mean, I know some of those words.
Right, no, I think you get it, but
I get what you're saying.
What's going on is he's saying, look, you did not have necessarily sublime feelings when you saw that waterfall and said it was sublime. You had feelings of veneration. You had excited feelings, calm feelings. You had all kinds of feelings.
Okay, what is veneration?
Exalted, let's just say excited.
Okay.
Okay. You had, wow, that is amazing. Mm-hmm. You thought this was a wonderful thing.
Kind of in awe.
In awe. Mm-hmm. And you called it sublime. How could the waterfall be sublime? How could the waterfall be calm and sublime if you were excited and passionate?
Right. It's awesome.
You are not projecting your emotion onto the waterfall. You are identifying that the waterfall has some beauty, some quality of its own. You may feel feelings of hatred because you just got into an argument with somebody.
Mm-hmm.
But when you go and you walk by that waterfall, you're not projecting. You don't look at that waterfall and you go, that waterfall is ugly and mean.
I see what you're getting at now.
You see the waterfall and you know that there is beauty there, even though I just got into an argument with my wife and I'm angry.
Right. The view of that waterfall could change your emotion.
Right. And so what C.S. Lewis is saying is, it's not that you have a feeling and that's valid to put on the waterfall. It's saying that that waterfall, it either is beautiful or it is not. It's either sublime or it is not. He says, your feelings, it goes on to say, the schoolboy who reads this passage in the Green Book, the book it got it from, will believe two propositions. Firstly, that all sentences containing a predicate of value are statements about the emotional state of the speaker. And second, that all such statements are unimportant. So you see what's happening here is just by telling him that, okay, when you see a sublime waterfall, you think it's sublime and it's just you, nothing else.
Right.
You have taught these children that the emotional states of the person who sees it is more important than what is really going on in the real world.
And that's not true.
And that's not true. Second, you have also taught him that those statements are unimportant. Because there's nothing real there. It's just your current emotional state.
Right.
And so is it true that our current emotional states are the most important thing? That there is no real beauty. There is no intrinsic good. There is no bad out there.
And that's on that slippery slope of saying that I am the only thing that matter.
Right.
You know, and nothing else really matters, just my feelings.
Right. And now we get to the most important part. Lewis says, until quite modern times, all teachers and even all men believe the universe to be such that certain emotional reactions, check this out, on our part could either be congruous or incongruous to it. Believed, in fact, that objects did not merely receive, but could merit our approval or disapproval, our reverence, our contempt. He goes on, you know what he's saying is, like, until now, people actually thought something is beautiful, and you should believe it's beautiful. Right. It's not that you think, oh, there's a waterfall. What should I feel? What do I want to feel about that? He goes on and he says, some people agree with the tourist who called the cataract sublime and disagreed with the one who called it pretty. Was of course that he believed inanimate nature to be such that certain responses would be more just or ordinate or appropriate. And he believed correctly that the tourist thought the same. The man who called the waterfall sublime was not intending to describe his own emotions about it. He was claiming that the object was one which merited those emotions.
Right, and gave emotions to him.
Right.
Yeah.
Now he goes on, he talks about Augustine, Aristotle. They say the same thing. Aristotle even says that the aim of education is to make the pupil like and dislike what he ought.
Wow.
And we're going to finish up. That was the complicated stuff.
Yeah.
We're going to bring it down to the simpler stuff.
Whew, let's cool this thing off.
We're going to apply it. We're going to try to do two more listener questions and a Bible contradiction.
In the next segment. Nice. That's going to be busy.
I don't know how we're going
to
do that.
We're going to have to do some extra online content.
Maybe. We'll see. Go to truthrevolution.tv. And also come out to Revolution Church, 9 o'clock and 11:15 every Sunday morning. Catch you on the other side of this break.
Hey, this is Pastor Jeff from Revolution Church.
And I'm Dave. We've been growing and now we're going to two services.
Sunday morning at 9 a.m. or 11:15 a.m. Check us out at salinarevolution.com.
What if someone had never been to church before?
Well, most people here hadn't been for a long, long time, if ever, so don't worry, you'll fit in fine.
What to wear? Just be yourself. Jeans, t-shirt, tats, whatever.
Revolution Church, Sunday morning, 9 or 11:15 a.m.
salinarevolution.com or check us out on Facebook.
Revolution!
Hi, this is Pastor Jeff from Revolution Church. Not only am I the host of the Truth Revolution radio program, but I'm also a foster parent. Did you know that there are only 20 or 30 children in Salina that need to be adopted right now? Did you know that there are children in foster care who want to live in Salina, but are sometimes placed in other towns because we don't have enough foster homes here? I want to challenge you to consider foster care today. If you're interested in doing foster care, go to kfapa.com, that's K-F-A-P-A, as in the Kansas Foster and Adoptive Parent Association.com, K-F-A-P-A.com, and get more information. You can request information, email and ask any questions you want, or possibly even sign up to take a class about foster parenting. It's easier and more difficult than you'd ever imagine, but it's also more rewarding than you'd ever imagine. Consider fostering and helping a child in need today.
Truth Shots from TruthRevolution.tv and Revolution Church. Here's your host, Dave, and Pastor Jeff.
Albert Einstein has been quoted as saying, "The most incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it is comprehensible."
We've only got 60 seconds, but pause for a second and think about the immensity of that statement.
Okay, enough. We can understand the world around us. The fact we can comprehend things and our universe isn't pure randomness means something.
If, flying in a plane, you looked down and saw a lone island with all the rocks organized to spell out H-E-L-P, you would never say, "Wow, what a coincidence of natural formation."
It's comprehensible, and because it is, you know, intelligence was at work.
Stephen Hawking, who's not a Christian, wrote, "It would be very difficult to explain why the universe should have begun in just this way, except as the act of a God who intended to create beings like us."
For more information, read Dr. Hugh Ross's book, Why the Universe Is the Way It Is.
TruthRevolution.tv.
Did you know that Truth Revolution is supported by Revolution Church and listeners like you?
It takes quite a bit of time and money to produce a quality radio show.
If you find Truth Revolution helpful, a donation would be a powerful way to make sure the message keeps going out.
This ministry is doing more than Dave and I imagined it would at the beginning.
You got that right.
And as we grow, we want to keep the goal the same, to be the place where faith and reason meet.
Donations are accepted at www.truthrevolution.tv or Revolution Church.
Truth Revolution.
And we're back. Wow, that was a long 3 minutes.
TruthRevolution.tv. Get out to the website. You can listen to more content, online content.
Right. You can even make a donation.
That's right.
You know, the listeners are what drive this radio show. We wouldn't be on the air if it wasn't for donations.
That's right.
You know, so.
And, let me just be honest here for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
We had a major donor who is just... I'm just not able to give quite as much.
Right.
Our main donor. And so, if you guys feel like you like Truth Revolution and you've been thinking about donating, this is a great time to do it.
Right.
So, we're not in debt or anything like that. We're not going to go in debt. We'll just go off the air.
All you'll hear on Sundays is crickets.
But we're on like 12 or 13 channels right now. We just,
if God we actually provide. Go off the air, what I'm going to do is I'm going to actually pay for time of my own for the radio station to just play crickets for half an hour.
People would be like, "Actually, this makes a lot more sense."
Right.
No.
All right, let's get back on subject. Right.
So that was just an awful plea for...
Wasn't it?
We are not marketers. That's not our job. All right, so anyway, St. Augustine...
But we should be.
St. Augustine says the same thing as C.S. Lewis... And so does Aristotle,
mm-hmm.
that beauty is not something that we see, it's something that is.
Right.
It's right. Not that the waterfall, I looked at it and I thought, well, that's sublime. And so I think it's sublime, so therefore it is. It's that the waterfall actually is sublime.
Right. But when you talk about, about art, is that subjective or is that objective? Or
No, it'd be the same thing.
Right.
So some things are beautiful and some things are not beautiful.
So the painter paints the painting... knowing, hey, this is beauty, and I'm putting it on canvas.
That's right. That's what artists used to do.
Okay.
Used to.
And they don't do that anymore.
Yeah, see, St. Augustine, this is what Lewis says, St. Augustine defines virtue as the ordinate condition of the affections in which every object is accorded that kind of degree of love, which is appropriate to it. In other words...
I said it was going to get easier after
virtue,
the break.
Listen, it's just really easy. Virtue. Okay, is this thing good or not?
Mm-hmm.
And the right type of virtue is for me to say that is really good if it's really good, moderately good if it's moderately good, really ugly if it's really ugly. In other words, you are describing it as it really is,
right.
And you're not saying, well, I think it's beautiful even though it's ugly.
Right. Everything has its own merit.
Right. Everything has merit. Aristotle says that the aim of education is to make the pupil like and dislike what he ought. When the age where reflective thought comes, the pupil, who has been thus trained in ordinate affections, will easily find the first principle in ethics. But to the corrupt man, they will never be visible at all, and he can make no progress in that science. Plato, before him, had said the same. The little human animal will not at first have the right responses. It must be trained to feel pleasure, liking, disgust, and hatred at those things which are really pleasant, likable, disgusting, and hateful. In other words, when your children are growing up, you teach them what is right and what is wrong, what mm-hmm. is beautiful and what is ugly. And if you're teaching them that ugly things are beautiful, they're going to grow up thinking that wrong is right.
Right. I can see where you'd make that leap because you look at society today.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's just things are getting a little out of whack.
Exactly. I mean, of course, people are calling wrong right and right wrong in mm-hmm. a society where we have art that is ugly and we say this is beautiful.
Right.
And everybody knows. I'm sorry, but everybody knows it's ugly. It's that they've been trained to say this is beautiful, even though it's not.
Right. And then to look at a sunset and say that's not beautiful. Well.
And that's just wrong. And we know it's wrong. And when you have that type of mixed up affection for beauty, you also have that type of mixed up affection for morality because it goes through your whole being. Now, okay, let's go ahead and get to another listener question.
I got a question.
We got questions coming out our ears today.
Yes, we got questions all over the place.
All right, second question of today is about your teleological argument for God.
Good.
You give the famous intricate, which implies the watchmaker argument. This begs the question, so who made God? If all things which are intricate and beautiful, which God must surely be, require a maker, then why would not God require such?
Okay, so who made God? And he's talking about the teleological argument.
Mm-hmm.
That's an interesting question. If everything that's intricate and beautiful requires a maker, why doesn't God require a maker?
Right.
Well, just to clarify, we didn't say everything that's intricate and beautiful requires a maker. We said all things that have great design, or all things that have design have a designer. Right. If there's great design, there must be a great designer.
Because you can have intricate and beautiful without somebody actually designing it.
Right. And so we said everything that has design was designed.
Right.
And the universe shows great designs. So right. The universe has great designer.
I.e. the universe kind of looks like a watch.
Right. Well, first of all, let's just grant the argument. Let's just mm-hmm. say, okay, God was designed by some greater God.
Okay.
Does that mean God doesn't exist?
No.
I mean, God still exists.
Right.
And all we have is God. And we are supposed to worship God.
Right.
So we still, that doesn't really actually change anything. Even if God was made by someone or something else, we still have a God that we're obligated to worship who created us.
Right. And we don't believe that, by the way. I mean, as far as God being created by something else.
No, I don't think so, no. But even if that were the case, right. It doesn't change the fact that Jesus came to earth and he was God incarnate and we're supposed to worship him. He fulfilled prophecy. But the other thing is that we have to go to the cosmological argument too. We don't think God had a beginning. And you have to have a beginning to have a designer.
Right. And God himself says that he is everlasting.
Right.
From everlasting to everlasting means he lives forever.
That's right. And so if you have no beginning, you actually can't have a designer. Right.
He's an uncreated being.
So that's why God can't be designed. He's uncreated. He's always been. So that's the answer for that. Now, let's go ahead and I think, Dave, we need to do our Bible contradiction for today.
Bible contradiction.
All right, Bible Contradiction today brought to you by the fine folks at infidels.org.
How do you feel about the fact that we advertise for atheists every single week?
You know, that's fine because I think it's only fair, honestly.
They don't advertise for us.
It doesn't matter. Two rights don't make a wrong. All right. So
That doesn't make any sense either.
I know. I rarely do. All right. The Bible contradiction today, the question is, were the Nephilim destroyed by the flood or not? Now, the Nephilim were the giants, you know. In Genesis 6:4, the Nephilim were on the earth in those days and also afterward when the sons of God went to the daughters of humans and had children by them. They were the heroes of old, men of renown.
Okay.
So basically, Genesis 6:4 is saying there were Nephilim before the flood.
Okay, and then Genesis 7, everything dies.
Yeah, everything dies. We know the story. Okay, Numbers 13:33, we saw the Nephilim there. The Nephilim were there after the flood? What gives, Jeff?
So did the flood destroy the Nephilim or not?
Right.
Now, before the show, as we're about to record, you said you had an idea.
I did.
What? That was brilliant.
I forgot what it was already.
No, you didn't.
Kidding. I'm just kidding. You know, God told Noah to take two of every living creature and to take it. Takest thou them into thine ark.
Is that how he said it?
That's just the way some people make fun of the Bible talk and stuff like it. But God basically said, take two of every living creature and put it in the ark.
Yeah.
You know, that way life will be propagated afterwards.
So the Nephilim
could have been
in the passengers. Ark.
They could have had their ticket, punched it right there at the door. Noah could have punched their ticket right there at the
door. Right there. So the Nephilim were on the ark.
Could have been.
Boy, that makes a lot of sense.
It does.
And so the fact that
it's
there.
Too easy, man.
So the fact that they were there after the flood is not that big of a deal. And actually, in fact, they could have brought seven of them on the ark.
That's true, because there are some passages where God
there's seven of certain seven, creatures. Yes. So we just don't know. Wow, that's fascinating. See, I was just going to say that we don't exactly know what the Nephilim were.
True.
And you have to give the Bible credit, or C in that cracked acronym. The second C is credit. And you look at Genesis 6:4, and he says, the Nephilim were on earth in those days, and also afterward. And so he admits up front the Nephilim were there before and after the flood.
Right.
So everything else he says has to be taken in that context of him saying, hey, they were here before and they were here afterwards. So whatever else I say, know this right up front.
You can't just cut that little piece out and then take the rest of it for value.
Right. So this is definitely not a Bible contradiction.
Bible contradiction.
So that's the answer there. That's
pretty simple, actually.
Yeah.
You know, and honestly, I mean, you know, they call people giant.
They could have just been big dudes.
Right.
But it does say they were descendants of Anak, so maybe not. But and either way, you know, we're going to do the third listener question. We're going to do that online only.
Okay, yeah, we're running out of time.
Because we are running out of time. Although it talks about, why can't the universe have existed forever? So that's a good question.
Right.
But hey, get over to truthrevolution.tv if we haven't said that enough already. Truthrevolution.tv.
Right, check out past shows. You can check out Truth Shots 3 times a week.
Truth Shots are every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, where we have 60 seconds of truth.
It's basically like condensing an entire show down into 60 seconds.
That's right. 30 minutes into one.
Right. You get your head swelled up full of knowledge.
We talk really fast.
We do. No. We sound like mice.
All right. But, you know, before we're done today, or before we get to the listener online stuff only, I just want to make the point about from C.S. Lewis's book, The Abolition of Man.
All right.
Okay. Things have beauty intrinsically or not. They really do. Lewis says, it is the doctrine of objective value. The belief that certain attitudes are really true and others are really false. Now, if there is a sublime waterfall and you think it's stupid and ugly, you're wrong.
Right.
And that's okay to say, people. He says, those that know the Tao or the reality of beauty can hold to that. To call children delightful or old men venerable is not simply to record a psychological fact about our own parental or filial emotions, but to recognize a quality which demands a certain response from us.
Amen.
So, all right. So anyway, that's great. Thanks for joining us today at Truth Revolution. Go to truthrevolution.tv and get out to Revolution Church. You know, we just love to have you.
We do. And don't forget, hey, next week.
Yeah.
We're going to be talking about
Dr. Zmirnik, multiverse. We're having a special guest on. He's an astrophysicist. He worked at UCLA as a researcher. He's working on an experiment to detect dark matter, and he's coming on to talk about the existence of multiverses.
Wow.
And whether or not that shows God can't exist.
You don't want to miss that.
It's going to blow your mind. It's going to blow our minds. We're just going to sit here and awe for 30 minutes. We're going to buy an extra airtime just to put on crickets.
There you go.
All right. Thanks for coming out. TruthRevolution.tv and Revolution Church, 9 and 11:15 every Sunday morning.
See ya.
Revolution.
And we're online.
I'm glad you're at truthrevolution.tv, or you've downloaded the podcast, or somehow you've gotten this content illegally.
What?
I don't know. We don't actually sell it for money, so I don't know how you could have it illegally.
Welcome to our virtual home.
You thief.
Whatever.
All right. Let's just get to the third listener question.
All right.
Before I accuse these hackers of being criminals.
What are you talking about?
I'm not venerating it properly.
So. All right. Our third listener question, if I can really find... There it is. If I can find it. All right. Third listener question of the day. This is the first time we've ever done three listener questions in a day.
Although we did have to go online. We should admit that right up front.
If God requires no maker and always existed... then can't the universe lay claim to the same status?
Yep. All right. That does it for our show today. What? Thanks for listening.
Whatever. What are you talking about?
Okay. We
did
say...
Did not God make the universe?
Yes, God made the universe.
All right.
But this person's asking for some consistency from us.
Okay.
He's saying if God didn't require a maker, if God didn't have to have a maker, couldn't the universe not have a maker? Could the universe just have always been like God always was?
Well, you have the, what is it, the third law of thermodynamics?
Second law the of second thermodynamics. Law of,
well, I've never been good at math, but I know. The second law of thermodynamics says that everything actually eventually winds down and heat dissipates.
Entropy.
Everything, yeah, entropy. Everything becomes even.
Mm-hmm.
And so our universe is not really that old in a... eternity perspective.
Right. I mean, we think the universe is, you know, over 14 billion years old. Mm-hmm. But if it was infinitely old, as this would imply, we would have run out of energy so long ago that we never would have come into existence.
Right.
It just can't happen. That's scientists know that. And that's why most scientists will not say that the universe is infinitely old, right. And they're trying to come up with some sort of oscillating model or some way to show the universe can come in and out of existence.
And then there's the whole deal about if the universe is infinitely old, we never would have arrived at this point in time to do the radio show.
That's right, because you cannot pass an actual number of infinite points.
Right. So if you actually want to believe the universe is infinitely old, turn your radio off right now because you're not listening to us. Because we're not talking.
Right. Well, let's just, to put it as an example, let's say that it is from here to the moon is an infinity away.
Okay.
Okay. It's not a set number of miles. It's infinitely far away. How long will it take you to walk to the moon? Well, you will never get there. Yeah, it's infinitely far away.
It would be an infinite amount of days.
No, you wouldn't get there, period. You just wouldn't if it was infinitely far away.
It'd be like walking on a treadmill.
Right. How long would it take you to get halfway?
The same amount.
Forever. You could never even get halfway because it's not a set distance.
Right.
And so if the universe had always existed, you actually would have never gotten to this particular point where you exist because it would have been too long ago. You cannot traverse an infinite amount of actual points
in
time.
So what you're saying is basically stop walking, pitch tent, and wait for the moon to come to you.
Something like that. So
that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, but really, and you know, this actually goes really well next week. We're doing the multiverse thing with Dr. Zmirnik, and we can, you know, talk to him about the universe and whether or not it actually could be old.
That's a nice little warmer upper for next week.
Oh, it's going to be awesome. So Dr. Zmirnik from Reasons to Believe next week. Don't miss it on Truth Revolution. You're on truthrevolution.tv right now, unless you hack this, you hacking hacker. And
obviously there's something behind this. And so, tune in next week and find out.
Check out Truth Shots. Donate if you're willing. And I just thankful for you guys. And come out to Revolution Church every Sunday morning at 9 o'clock and
11:15.
That's right, Dave.
You don't want to miss it.
You got it. Dave's a bass player. He's going to rock that sucker.
Right.
He's going to thump that bass.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to rock the guitar.
When have I ever known to thump a bass?
I don't know. I'll bring my hammer and hit it.
There you go.
I was like, hammer time. All right. So anyway, Truth Revolution, thanks for coming out today. Pass this on to your friends.
We'll see you next week, right?
Truth Revolution.tv.